Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tylenol. We shouldn't do that. It's so weird. RFK Jr. promised that he'd reveal the cause of autism by September. It was a self-imposed deadline that left little room for actual considered science. The medical establishment held its breath, hoping that he wouldn't use his perch as Secretary of Health and Human Services to go after vaccines. When the deadline hit, he pointed his finger not at vaccines, but at Tylenol. In a press conference with Donald Trump, RFK Jr. announced that Tylenol use in pregnancy could lead to autism. He said this based on thin observational data, not the gold standard randomized control trials we like to see before making such bold claims from the perch of the presidency. Now, the FDA isn't banning Tylenol, nor is it saying that if you take it that you'll get autism right now. But the way they made this announcement, the lead up, the framing, the timing, made it seem like they'd made some sort of major discovery when they just hadn't. This has led to a lot of confusion among parents and physicians alike. Today I'm joined by Dr. Rachel Bedard. She's a real-life medical doctor and also a columnist here at The Argument. She has spent her career working with vaccine skeptical communities at Rikers Island during the pandemic and in New York working with homeless populations right now. We unpack what the evidence actually shows about Tylenol and autism. We talk about why shouting misinformation at RFK Jr. is the wrong way to respond. And we talk about how to do science, how to revitalize public health, without lying to ourselves or to the public. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, I bring together folks all across the political spectrum, from socialists to conservatives, in conversation with one another, talking about the most important issues of the day. The Argument is against subtweeting. We state our opinions clearly, and we engage with our opponents directly. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can go to theargumentmag.com to subscribe. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So last time we did this episode, it was it January of this year on a separate podcast, on a separate network, at a different magazine. We shall not speak her
name. That's right, but we've reunited.
Yeah. And we were talking right as RFK was being considered for HHS secretary. And about the MAHA coalition that you've spent a lot of time thinking about and in your own work as a doctor have really engaged with people who are, maybe they don't call themselves MAHA, but they have like vaccine skeptical beliefs or other beliefs around health that have been, you know, I think people would consider from, you know, like a liberal perspective as like anti-science or anti-public health. And, you know, I think that like now that we're like several months into this, it's like very useful to think about like what it's been like to watch MAHA come into power. And I am still stuck on, and this just happened last week for us, this will be airing later, but Trump getting up in front of the entire world and making the claim that Tylenol increases prevalence of autism. And I had not ever heard of this. Like, I'd heard, like, the vaccine autism thing. I'd never heard of the Tylenol autism thing. So I'm hoping that you can just, like, situate us for this. Like, where did this come from? Is this a big thing within the MAHA RFK coalition? Have they been talking about Tylenol for a while? Have none of the country moms been taking Tylenol? Should we be on Motrin? Like, what are we supposed to be taking? Like, what is this?
Yeah, so I think it's useful to sort of back up about the autism announcement and sort of where that came from first. So the MAHA coalition, what we're calling the MAHA coalition in this conversation, what I sort of refer to as the MAHA coalition when I talk about this, is it is a loose association of people who have some overlapping concerns and interests, but it's really diverse. And it didn't exist as a coherent movement until last summer, mm-hmm. summer of 2024, when RFK was running for president. And he was assembling this coalition behind him of people whose overlapping concerns are that they are worried about the chronic disease epidemic. They're worried about clean air, clean water, clean soil. They're worried about toxins. Mm-hmm. And related to those things, there is a segment of the coalition that's very preoccupied with vaccines and the danger of vaccines. The anti-vax subgroup is not the majority of the folks who are sort of RFK curious, I would say. And within the anti-vax subgroup, there are actually different, it's like, it's all pretty Byzantine. Like, there's Children's Health Defense, which is the organization that Bobby Kennedy chaired from 2015 to 2023, which is the sort of locus of hardcore anti-vax activism and advocacy in the U.S. That group has been focused on anti-vax stuff since well before the pandemic. There are also people who are focused exclusively basically on the mRNA vaccines, mm-hmm. whose anti-vax stuff came up during the pandemic COVID, when they got really into the idea that this particular technology, the mRNA technology, was dangerous. So that's all to say that like the background is that there's this sort of wide group of folks who are into him. One of those sort of subgroups is that there are moms who have kids with disabilities who feel that their particular kid's situation arose after being vaccinated, or have some other hypothesis about like the etiology behind their particular child's condition, mm-hmm. or who just have questions about it and feel that those questions go ignored or unanswered by conventional medicine. Those moms are not the majority of parents of kids with autism. They don't represent like the bulk of parents of kids with disabilities, but there is a subgroup of parents of kids with disabilities who have those questions. In the spring, RFK made this announcement that he was going to discover, they were going to announce the cause of autism by September. It was a
crazy thing to say. Like, what was pushing him to say that?
Right. So reading between the lines, what I think was going on was that he had made this commitment to this particular subgroup of his coalition, to this sort of like this disability moms community. That, again, is not all disability parents, but other disability parents who are sort of associated with him. I think he had made a commitment to his anti-vax base that he was going to pursue the mandate that they had given him to look into the sort of science of the relationship between vaccines and autism. Mm-hmm. I also think that Trump himself has always had sort of like a kooky hobbyist interest in vaccines, like sort of vaccines and what, like he's been tweeting since 2013, Trump mm-hmm. has, about the idea that we give kids too many vaccines all at once, in the way that Trump tweets about lots of things, where it's like a little off the cuff. He's just sort of like having an everyman reaction to it. He's like, seems like a lot of shots.
Just asking questions.
Yeah, now just I'm asking president. Questions. Yeah, exactly. Right. And he's just taking that attitude all the way to the White House. And so Trump's had that sort of like question for a long time. There is apparently this, you know, people say now that in his first term, he had wanted to have Kennedy come along and help lead a commission on this. And then in the first term, when he'd had sort of more responsible people around him, they'd said no. So Trump was interested in it. His anti-vax base is interested. He has this base of disability parents of kids with disabilities who are interested in it, who have all given him this mandate. Bobby Kennedy needs wins because he needs to make news and he needs to keep his base happy and he needs to keep the president happy. Because he is like, he's got his own sort of political agenda that he's pursuing. And he made this overcommitment basically in May. He said, okay, like I'm going to do it. We're going to find the cause of autism by September. It was a timeline that made it impossible that they would do any sort of like really new science, right? That would totally advance our understanding of this. They didn't really give any specifics at the time about what they intended to do. They were like, we're going to use all of our data. We're going to use the power of the federal government. We're going to crack this case. Mm-hmm. Labor Day comes and goes. There's no report. Like, we're a week into September. There's no report. And they're literally being like, it's coming any day now. It's coming any day now. Like, get ready. And then the weekend before, so the announcement was on September 22nd. The weekend before, Trump is at some dinner where he's like, you know, yapping at the microphone. And he says to Marty McCarry, the head of the FDA, who's in the audience, he starts yapping about the how he's ready. Trump says, I'm ready to tell everybody what the deal is. If what we've learned is true, it's really important. And he says, Marty, I want to tell them on Monday. Stop waiting. If it's wrong, it's wrong. It's not a big deal, Marty. I want to release it on Monday. I don't want to wait until Tuesday. So it's clear that what happened is that, like, there was a real, like, night before group project dynamic to this whole thing where
he had over the Google Doc yelling.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're like, fuck. So it's like late, you know, it's their past deadline. They've made this big commitment. Trump took it seriously and is pretty interested in the question. They've brought him the inkling that there is some signal in the noise of all of the different sort of research that's been done on autism, that Tylenol might be an implicated factor in some cases. That evidence is very thin, and it's observational trials, and there are other studies that are sort of better in their design that suggest that there's not really a relationship at all. Like, it's based on very little. They've done no new research to suggest that there's this association. Like, they haven't discovered anything new. But the reason that the Tylenol explanation is a good one for RFK is because the thing that does unite that MAHA coalition again is this idea that the chronic disease epidemic is due to environmental exposure. Mm-hmm. So Children's Health Defense's mission is to rid the world of childhood epidemics that are due to environmental exposures. They don't believe, and RFK says this all the time very explicitly, that epidemics can be due to genetic factors, because genetic evolution doesn't happen fast enough for prevalence to rise as quickly as we've seen mm-hmm. autism cases rise. They don't believe, they say it has to be due to an exposure. Mm-hmm. So they needed to find an exposure explanation. The pressure and expectation was that he was going to say something about vaccines. But vaccine policy is in his domain. And if he had made an announcement that the MMR is really implicated in escalating cases of autism, he would have been obligated to then take some action around that. And Bobby Kennedy's very cross-pressured on this issue, because the majority of Americans, like the vast majority of Americans, believe vaccines are safe and that they're important. They don't want to see school vaccine mandates rolled back. They don't share these questions and concerns. Mm-hmm. And so he has his base, he has the president, and he has an eye on the American people, because I think Kennedy wants to run for president in 2028. So I think everything he does is trying to, like, wiggle his way through this pretty tight spot where he has these different constituencies that he's trying to sort of keep at bay while he continues to make a lot of news without disqualifying him in front of the American people for a presidential run. So I think he decided not to, I think that he wasn't in a position where he could say, he could come out and blame vaccines.
How much of this is like kind of like the dog caught the car situation? Is it like
100%?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, you know, he is in this position now to finally do something that he's been railing against for ages. And like, he's not like someone who is speaking very cautiously outside of the administration, right? Like, I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who you've talked to me about where there's like, hey, like, I've noticed a large increase in autistic children and a diagnosis happening, and like, I'm concerned about that. Like, why is that happening? Like, just asking questions, but like, not in a pejorative way, like actually just asking questions. And like, RFK Jr. was not just asking questions. He was like spending years of his life blaming vaccines.
He's a super interesting guy, because he, I think, is popularly perceived and presents himself as this sort of crusader, truth teller, unafraid to, you know, buck the establishment by doing real science that uncovers the real explanations. That I think is a persona he's constructed and presented to the world. I think some of that is performance. Again, that really effective performance that has built him a significant following. And that actually he's a very canny political actor. And so the Tylenol autism example is a really good one, where tons of like brouhaha, right? Like all this lead up, then the whole country kind of stops and watches this rando press conference at 4 p.m. because it's like so weird. And they make this announcement. And on the one hand, it's a big deal. It's a big deal it's just fundamentally a big deal for the president and the head of HHS to get up and share such shitty science and put like the federal government's weight behind what is incredibly thin
evidence. They said they're going to start telling doctors and physicians, FDA will advise them for pregnant women not to take Tylenol. So it's like, you know, it's not nothing.
And they're going to put a warning on the box.
Yeah.
I think, right? Like that's what the FDA can do. That's the action that they're taking. So it's not that it's nothing at all. It creates like a lot of anxiety and confusion and all of those things. But they're not taking Tylenol off the market, right? And compared to what might have happened, which is he gets up and says, "Yep, it's the MMR," or it's too many childhood vaccines before the age of two, or whatever it was, and we're going to take those things off the schedule. Mm-hmm. The impact here is relatively less dire. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not to say it's not bad. I think he was trying to sort of figure out how to like wriggle through this space in a way where he could do something that seemed decisive, revelatory, that fit the framework that his base has for where neurodevelopmental conditions come from, and at the same time hold at bay the pressures to implicate vaccines in a way that would then put him in a position of having to take action around it. All the way through his term, he has talked about vaccines with like a huge amount of sort of sinister, he's always implicating that like something big is going to come and big changes are coming. He fired all of those the members of the CDC advisory committee, ACIP, overnight, like this like night of the long knives, fired all of the Biden appointed advisors. He stacked the committee with his own people, many of whom are just like known anti-vaccine conspiracists. Tons and tons of drama. Ultimately, the recommendations that advisory board have made so far are pretty minor. They have made recommendations around COVID boosters for children and pregnant women. Fewer than 15% of American kids or pregnant women got the COVID booster last year. So it's not like, is it bad? Is it bad to make recommendations that limit people's access to vaccinations that they may want? Sure. Those are not our most effective vaccines, and they are actually still available in conversation with a physician if you have qualifying conditions, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not the worst intervention he could have made. And then the other main sort of thing that came out of the last ACIP meeting is they decided not to approve a combined measles, mumps, rubella, varicella shot, the MMRV, for kids under two. That shot is known, and this is like good evidence, known to be implicated in higher rates of febrile seizures. So kids get it, they get a fever, and then they have a seizure.
But that's like how often is that happening? Is that like a rare?
Like not that often. Yeah. Not that often. And if it happens, it resolves.
Yeah.
But it's a thing. And they said, okay, we're not going to do this combined shot in kids under two, but you can still get the MMR and the varicella separately. Mm-hmm. Again, it's not the recommendation, I think, that a serious committed committee of experts would have made. Mm-hmm. But in the sort of scheme of things that they could have done so far, it is less dramatic than I think people maybe have feared.
So there's like basically two things I want to pull out of what you're saying. And like one of those things is this sort of this idea that there are electoral and other types of pressures that are limiting the actions that could be taken by RFK, the Trump administration, et cetera. And I think the thing that's interesting here is, like, first of all, obviously this is a very extreme administration. Like, the things that we're witnessing, particularly in some areas, I think on tariffs and on immigration, we're seeing, like, quite extreme actions being taken well beyond what I think the majority of people expected going in. I mean, yes, there was a lot of talk about, like, tariffs and mass deportation, but I don't think people expected troops on the ground in Los Angeles, in Chicago, in Washington, D.C., and that it was largely going to be non-criminals who were going to be picked up from, law-abiding immigrants who are trying to go to their court hearings. Like, that was, like, not the picture that was being painted by the administration. And then on tariffs, of course, like, they needed, like, 50% tariffs, 100% tariffs. Like, these numbers are, like, way beyond what I think most people were expecting, particularly from the first term. And then to see in this area, right, in this area where there's also been a lot of concern about, like, what's going to happen in this post, like, kind of COVID moment around public health in the Trump administration, but also on the right in general, like, what does this look like? I like, wonder, like, what you're thinking is, like, why do they feel so constrained here where they don't feel so constrained in other areas? And I think maybe some people listening to this are going to go, like, constrained, like, this stuff is really bad, like, you guys are minimizing this. But I think that, like, what you're saying is really important, like, relative to, like, what could happen. Like, RFK is HHS secretary. Like, what he could do with vaccine schedules. And maybe that's worth painting a picture here of, like, what a dystopian, like, what is, like, the 100% tariff version of RFK taking vaccines more seriously from his perspective would look like. And then why is he not doing that?
Yeah, so a few things. So the first thing is, like, you know, has he done like everything in Trump world, like, there's so much moving the goalposts, right? Because they're so crazy and they're so norm violating and they're so fundamentally destructive to institutional practices. He has allowed the CDC to be hollowed out, both in terms of cuts and then people just leaving because they can't work there anymore, right? He appointed and then immediately fired, you know, a sort of responsible CDC head and has now put in an acting head who's like his political crony. This committee is stacked with goofballs. Like, to watch this ACIP meeting that just happened in September, like, people were literally whispering, like, what are we voting on? Like, they were not prepared for this pretty wild task that they had before them, which is making vaccine policy for 300 million people. Like it is, none of it's minimizing, but I do think that I perceive what I think is different about what's happening with RFK is that I perceive RFK as an independent political actor in the MAGA coalition. I think RFK wanted to be president, sincerely. Every time I talk about him, I talk about this, but he is a guy who, like Trump, where if you now look at Trump's, like, when Trump was first running, everyone was like, Donald Trump's running for president? That's so silly. And then now, second term in, you look back, you can see evidence that Trump was always a politically engaged, ambitious person who believed himself to be a person who could eventually go to the White House. You can see evidence from interviews he did in the 80s, right? Yeah. Like, you can trace the tariff stuff to interviews he gave in the 80s. RFK is the same. He is a Kennedy. He always was in the public eye. He always, when he was an attorney advocate who sort of always occupied this, like, professional public role as an environmental activist. And
I mean, you know, anyways, he reminds me of Nader. Like, it's like not.
He's like Nader. Yeah. He's also like Trump. Like, he was always sort of like foot in many worlds, kind of maybe kind of weird and silly, but also part of the elite. Mm-hmm. In 2000, he considered a run for Congress. He was considered for EPA head under Obama. He was on the shortlist to replace Hillary Clinton when she gave up her Senate seat to become Secretary of State. So he carries the, like, legacy of his family and is also their black sheep. So, like, there's a lot going on there. And he has been building power in sort of a non central political arena, but a politicized arena his whole career. COVID happens. It's a huge sort of catalyst and platform for him because it brings so many people's focus onto his issues. Mm-hmm. Like Trump, there are no other, they are the two people over 70 who are the best at social media in the world. he's very good at it. Yeah. Like he really understands, and not just as in he's good in the way that Trump is, like he has a weird, his own style and his own, mm-hmm. but like he just understands it. Like he understands how to sort of like deploy a message. He understands how to amplify. He understands how to connect with people and have them.
He also has like a type amplify. Of message that's like built for social media. Like this totally. Type of like conspiracizing sort of like, it can also fit in sound bites. It's like not a level of nuance that requires like long form text, you know?
Totally. Although he does do like, he does a Bill Ackman style tweet, like no other, like he does a 2000 word tweet, no problem. Yeah. And he made this video yesterday. We can talk about this, like a 7 minute video. Like he loves to do a big, long debunking, but he just really, he really gets it. He really gets how to use the contemporary media ecosystem. So it comes along. He decides he's going to run for president. He initially says he's going to run as a Democrat and then quickly decides he's going to run as an independent. The story that I've heard from lots of people and that's been sort of well documented in the media is that when he decides he's going to drop out in the summer of 2024, they reach out to the Democrats. His campaign reaches out to the Democrats to say, okay, look, we'll drop out. We'll come into you. What can you offer him? The Democrats are like, don't even take the call. Mm-hmm. And then Charlie Kirk and like Don Jr. like broker this sort of arrangement with MAGA. And Trump's like, yeah, he can come in and have HHS secretary if that's the job he wants. Like Trump doesn't give a shit. And that's how this sort of unlikely marriage happens. Mm-hmm. But the idea that HHS secretary is this man's dream job, I think, is not right. I think he wants to be president. And Trump invited him in because he believes that Kennedy has his own base, mm-hmm. and that Trump needs that base to win or needs that base to stay in power. MAGA has become very convinced. Steve Bannon is very convinced about this. It's like a big source of this. Bannon was an early Kennedy supporter in his presidential run, that sort of the MAGA MAHA coalition is that's like unbeatable. Mm-hmm. That's really like the big tent. And so, well,
so I mean, like, I guess, like, I mean, what's funny to me is that in many ways, this is like a masterclass in how Trump should have handled like the Epstein files. Right. So like in very similar ways, you have promises made to a very hardcore committed base that has like obsessed with the issue, that like has very, very strong feelings, where there's like a mix of like real concerns around abuse of minors and all the way to like just like crazy conspiracies about like widespread sexual abuse in like the elite levels of the party, like a la like Pizzagate type stuff. And that coalition of people is like promised a very concrete thing, like with Kennedy on the vaccines, like they're promised very concretely, you're gonna go after vaccines and they're linked to autism. With Trump and Epstein, like we're gonna release the Epstein files, like it's a very, very clear thing. Similarly, both of them put, like they have officials put like very clear lines in the sand, right? Like Pam Bondi comes out with like, what was even in these fucking binders now? I have no idea. Like comes out in front of everyone and goes, we're gonna get these out to you, it's gonna happen, and like creates all this excitement, creates all this anticipation. And then like, in many ways, I mean, this really validates your thesis of this man as an extremely good political, like, actor, like a very smart political actor, that like he is, I'm sure, watching what happened with Epstein and watching the fact that like even the master of keeping his base in line, Donald Trump, like was unable to really do so when they were unwilling to fulfill this promise on the Epstein files. And it's created a lot of, I think, negative attention. I mean, we've seen this in our own polling at the argument around like Republicans are like very likely to believe that Trump is implicated in the Epstein crimes, and very likely to believe that Epstein was not like just did not just commit suicide in jail. And then with Trump here, it's like you're able to witness like the amount of backlash that comes if you just don't satisfy this portion of your base that you really rile up. And so, I mean, I guess like in my head here, like the idea that RFK is this extremely careful political actor, it's like hard to really square with my perception of him as sort of just like a lunatic.
He is. I mean, it is the same as Trump. So let's put the Epstein thing aside. Mm-hmm. Trump is a lunatic and a genius.
Yeah.
Right? He is both of those things. Kennedy is a lunatic and a genius, I think. And genius might be strong, but I have come to deeply respect this man. Not because I think he is, I think I also have come to see him as much more dangerous than I did before. Again, I think as with Trump, liberals have made the mistake with Kennedy for, we are doing the exact same thing. We are like, he's so weird. He's so unappealing. How could anyone respond to that? Everything he says is so patently crazy.
Yeah.
There's no broad appeal here. And we are missing something happening at like a frequency that the elite liberal just cannot hear that does speak to people. And he is much more intentional about his performance and his base building than we sort of see him as being, because we are like, he's like religious zealot about this stuff. Like I don't think that that's right. I think he does believe. I think this, his preoccupation with contamination, which is the through line of sort of all of his advocacy all the way along, running from water through vaccines, I think it's very sincere. I think his general gestalt idea that, I learned the term recently, terrain theory, which is like, so germ theory, right, attributes disease to viruses and bacteria and fungi that like, you know, invade the body. Miasma theory is a alternative hypothesis around disease that is was replaced by germ theory. But miasma theory believes that there's, you know, basically like sort of illness in the environment and the air that like is infecting us or sort of taking us over. Terrain theory is the idea that if we are our terrain needs to be resilient to invasion, destruction, and weakness. And if our terrain is healthy and in balance, we can ward off sickness.
And terrain, you mean like our bodies, our environment?
The terrain being our body. It's not miasma is the environment and terrain is the body. Like that if our terrain, you know, like a sick terrain gets infected and this and a healthy terrain doesn't. And I do think that Kennedy believes in sort of this combination terrain theory and miasma theory. The idea that like the danger is in the environment, and if you are strong enough to ward it off, then you don't get sick. And so he sees the goal of sort of all health and wellness to be about doing the things that help support people to be as strong as they can be, to be resilient and fortified against the invasion of their body by contaminant. And it's sort of a, there's not, we don't have another word, like it's not eugenics, right? Because it's actually not that interested in genetics. But it is eugenics adjacent in that it is very much like a survival of the fittest. It's just
it's also like really bizarre because it would indicate that like anyone who gets sick must have some underlying health issue that they have not resolved on their own. So like if and it creates, I mean, like it, to believe this, I'm like, pretty much on the line of like someone who would fully believe this. Like if I was like, you know, like I'm a healthy person, I'm like running marathons, I'm like going to like, you know, the gym 10 times a week and like doing, eating only like, you know, greens and high fiber foods and protein and like David bars, like whatever it is. Like, I'm just doing that all the time. And if I get sick, then I'm like, oh, like I have to root out like what it is inside of me that is causing this. And it creates like, I mean, it's like a level of like deep paranoia that has to be exhibited towards yourself. And also like, I mean, in some ways, like, and maybe I think it gets a lot at what you've talked to me about before of just like, it's deeply individualist. Like it's your fault. It's
deeply individualist.
It's your fault. You know,
it's deeply individualist. It's very, very like the will can master the body.
Yeah.
I think it relates like, to me, it's sort of like all on the surface with this guy. So I think it relates a ton to the fact that he was a fucked up, traumatized kid from this high profile family whose father and uncle were assassinated when he was an early teen. And then he had very severe drug and alcohol addiction. And then he went through recovery through AA and came out the other side of that, extremely committed to the idea that you can master things in your body that you don't like.
Yeah.
And that is one sort of strain of like thinking around addiction, that that it's a problem of will. That's a you know, that's a strain of thinking about obesity, right? And chronic disease. So like the idea that like it's very individualistic. It's very it is what you said, which is the idea that if you get sick, if you sort of allow yourself to succumb to illness, like something was fundamentally frail or wrong. And his more sort of hardcore anti-vax folks say, like a big talking point for them is that healthy kids don't die of measles. The only kids who die of measles were sick in some way beforehand. And that's just absolutely not true. Measles is incredibly dangerous and it absolutely kills and disables healthy children if they get infected.
But also, I think what's interesting here is like, let's say it was true. I'm not sure how much that changes anything I believe about like public health policy.
No, totally. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not, this isn't exactly what we're talking about, but it's, it's not so different from,
exactly,
you know what I'm going to say, which is like, you know, sort of the reports about kids starving in Gaza and then this like, sort of like gotcha effort that's like, well, the only kids who are dying of starvation were chronically ill kids, which, you know,
and
it's just
fuck
it's,
those kids.
Right. And it's
who
just,
cares?
It's irrelevant.
You know? Yeah.
It's irrelevant because chronically ill children also shouldn't starve, right?
Yeah.
Like it doesn't change anything sort of about the horror of it. But the
and also, of course,
implication is that there was something in them that was frail. They were going to die anyway. Mm-hmm. And that is, the really scary thing to me about the Kennedy ethos is this. It's this idea that like America is supposed to be pure and strong. It's very like Volk, you know, like it's very like the strength of the soil, the strength of the blood. Like we are supposed to sort of commit the national project to the idea of being as fortified as we can be. He talks a lot, very explicitly, about the connection between the chronic disease epidemic and the military, that, like, you know, that too few Americans are fit for military service.
Mm-hmm.
And those sort of broad ideas, like, really inform his political project. And those broad ideas have applications well beyond what HHS can do. And he's a really ambitious guy. So to go back to sort of what we were talking about, the reason that he is behaving in a way that I perceive to be both sort of more news forward and more cautious than other parts of the Kennedy coalition is because he is less, the Trump coalition is because he's a little bit less beholden to Trump in some ways, because he has this, you know, card in his pocket that he has his own base and he can take them with him. And he has his own agenda, which is that he wants to set himself up to be able to run in 28.
Yeah. I like, you know, I want to go back to something that you mentioned, which is that RFK, first of all, I mean, well known, was originally a Democrat, was seen on the left side of the coalition. Much of the MAHA coalition was, you know, as it's, you know, we call it that now, but it was just like crunchy granola moms, anti-vax moms. Like that was not like considered a right wing group of people. And you mentioned that RFK reached out to the Democrats when he was considering dropping out. And they rebuffed his advances or they didn't respond to his calls. And I think a big part of what you have been thinking through for a while is like, what do you do as a liberal when you have a coalition like this that is electorally important, is hostile in many ways to core values around, you know, collective public health measures that require some small sacrifices like getting a vaccination or you know, other non-pharmaceutical interventions during a pandemic that might hurt a lot of the populations that we want to take care of. And yet they're a very important political force. And they're one among many that the Democrats used to be able to keep in the coalition and that liberals used to be able to be a part of the coalition that no longer are able to be part of like what we're doing our project. And therefore you're seeing like mass losses, electoral losses happening across the country. And so I guess my question for you is like, you know, you talk a lot about how you need to engage with these ideas around, okay, you are concerned about autism, so let's talk about that. And so instead of like talking about how other people should do that, I want to do it like right now with you. So I'm going to inhabit someone who is discovering for the first time that autism diagnoses have gone up. And I would love for you to just kind of engage with me and like how you would do that as a doctor in your own practice as a coming into your office. So, you know, I've come across this graphic, the White House has shared it, 400% increase in autism diagnoses from 1992 to 2012. That is insane. And I notice it in my community. I notice it in my family. I see a lot more kids with autism diagnoses. I have friends who are working in school systems and they're coming across kids with autism diagnoses all the time. The behavioral problems are through the roof. Like, clearly something has changed in our atmosphere to create this issue. So like, what's going on?
I'm going to answer this, but can I just say two things
that I
want to correct in the, or sort of, I want to like probe in the setup.
Do it.
The first thing is that they're electorally important.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true? We don't know.
Yeah.
That is something that RFK really wants us to believe.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the MAHA vote won Trump the presidency is a thing that he says and Steve Bannon says and Marjorie Taylor Greene says. But like, is that a, you know, is that true? We don't know because it's very, very hard to get at in any kind of data, right?
What would you think? Do you think that they were? Obviously, any group of like a million people even could like shift an election massively. But like, you know, do you think it was important for Democrats to try to win those votes?
Yeah. So I would say that I think what is definitely true is that he campaigned around a set of concerns that were previously completely absent from the dominant national political conversation to the degree that healthcare, which has always been sort of a big political football, has been part of, you know, all of the elections that I can remember in my lifetime. What we have talked about is healthcare access,
mm-hmm.
right? And Democrats and Republicans having different positions around whether it's a human right to be able to go to the doctor, who should pay for you to be able to do it. RFK talked about health, not healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about declining standards in American health and declining life expectancy and a chronic disease epidemic. And he talked about food and water and soil and farms and like a host of things. What, you know, vaccines are like not actually sort of the major plank for most people in his platform. It's all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think it's absolutely without question true that Americans think that those are important questions. That they have been failed by their government, that they understand that we pay more than anyone else in the world for healthcare and yet have worse outcomes, and that Americans are dissatisfied and worried about their children. I think that's definitely true. Whether or not, and I think that motivated a ton of people to maybe enter politics around COVID. Like, I think COVID was this real radicalizing moment for a lot of people. And maybe RFK provided... is the charismatic leader that they could enter and then get excited about.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that means that they actually turned up and voted for him, I don't know. The people who said that they were RFK supporters in July of 2024, they're about 15% of people surveyed, like in, you know, sort of like who are you voting for surveys would say him. They were people who had often not voted before and people who didn't like either party and they were not registered. Mm-hmm. So whether his constituency showed up to the ballot box, whether they for sure voted for Trump because of him, I'm not positive.
Mm-hmm.
And then what the geographic distribution of those people is, like, not totally clear to me. There's tons to kind of learn there and probe, because it's possible that this is a bit of a mirage he's created to create a lot of strength around himself. That's the first thing I want to say. The second thing, so it's not that I don't think the Democrats absolutely need to engage these issues. I'm like obsessed with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we should engage them both on the merits. And I think we should engage them because now that he has politicized them, they have become central to the discourse.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that they were central to Trump's win.
Yeah.
The second thing I would say is I would probe this idea that liberals have that you said, which was asking people to make small sacrifices for the collective, like getting a vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just say that this, I think, is a real distinction. There are lots... I don't think it's a small thing to mandate vaccines. I think it's asking people, for people who don't trust the substance we're telling them they have to put in their bodies or that they have to put in their babies' bodies, it's a big deal. That's a big ask. And to do that in a low trust environment is asking people to do something they're deeply uncomfortable with, mm-hmm. and to downplay the fact that that is a coercive intervention, I think, is part of how we have lost people and continue to lose people. It's a big deal to tell people they have to put something in their body. I just want to make both of those points before we move on, which is to say, like, I think there's a sort of a bunch of assumptions now as the Kennedy narrative has gotten going. And those are two that we have to be a little bit skeptical around. Okay, what I would...
But that's not what you would say to me if I came into your office. You would be like, well, excuse me.
What I would say to you is I would say, tell me about your kid. Mm-hmm. And when did the diagnosis happen? Mm-hmm. And what was going on for you then? And what testing did you have? And tell me what it's like to live with him or her. Mm-hmm. And what kind of help do you have at home? And what's hardest about it? And what have you tried? And that sounds really hard. What are you most worried about? Mm-hmm. And in my individual physician practice, you can build trust by being incredibly relational. And that is what I do all the time. Mm-hmm. I have been a doctor my whole life for marginalized communities where there is incredibly low trust between the patients that I serve and the state. For 6 years I was a doctor in jail. There could not be a more low trust environment in which to practice medicine. And I would see guys over and over and over again who were, for various reasons, refusing medical interventions that were recommended to them that they direly really needed. Mm-hmm. And the way that we would get past that is, one, in building trust by building a real authentic relationship with one another. And two, I would try to really elicit what values and priorities and anxieties were driving their refusal. Mm-hmm. There is popularly, I think, this... So in your scenario, I'm not avoiding your scenario. We can role play if you want to role play. But in your scenario where you bring me this chart, mm-hmm. there's no way that you saw that chart and you were like, oh, and it was the first time that you thought about where your kid's autism came from.
Yeah.
Right? You've been wondering that and worrying about it. And maybe you feel guilty about it.
Yeah.
And you've been Googling it and you've been reading about it and you've been looking for...
And you're wondering, is it my fault?
And you've been wondering, is it my fault? Yeah. And you've been responding to the emotion of different chat rooms. There are rooms in which, you know, so some parents of kids with disabilities are very, very into disability rights. And they have sort of one framework within which they are having a conversation about what it's like for them. Others are very preoccupied with the idea that something bad happened to them that didn't need to happen. And their role going forward is to protect their kid from anything else happening.
Yeah.
They made a mistake because they said yes to a doctor without asking enough questions. And they got a vaccine and now their kid is sick. Mm-hmm. And they were never going to make that mistake again. Now they're going to question everything. Mm-hmm. And depending on you and your orientation and your politics and the support you have at home and the relationship you have with the doctor who diagnosed your kid and the doctor who gave the kid the vaccine and all of these things, you're going to respond to those different sort of stimuli differently, right? And my job, if you and I were talking about it, would be to understand it mm-hmm. as best I can, and then to help articulate out loud for you what I hear you saying, mm-hmm. both to help you sort of maybe reframe some stuff, but also to test what I'm hearing. So I hear you saying that you maybe feel guilty. You might be like, fuck you, I don't feel guilty. This isn't my fault. And then
it's your fault.
Yeah. And then I might say, okay, sorry, that's what some people feel. Like I misheard you. Tell me more about what you're hearing.
But like, let's say your goal is like, you know, let's say I have like two other kids who I'm now not vaccinating for anything. And, or at least I'm restricting a bunch of different vaccines. I mean, do you view it as your role as a doctor to try to convince me to get those kids vaccinated?
Well, that's the second part, I would say, which is my job is to think really hard about what the objective of our encounter is. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I want you to vaccinate those other kids. But is that the most important thing that I need to get out of our 15 minutes together today? Mm-hmm. Maybe, or maybe not. Maybe the thing that I need is to get you to come back. So I need to sit with you and talk to you in a way that doesn't make you feel like I'm pushing something on you. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the thing that I need is to get you to agree to take the antibiotic that you're also skeptical of, mm-hmm. or let the kid have the antibiotic that they're also skeptical of. This isn't being, and this is, I think, you know, before we started recording, you and I were talking about some of the COVID. Reflections on COVID stuff, right? That the idea that like now there's sort of this emerging consensus narrative that we fucked up everything in COVID. It's okay that I'm cursing in this podcast.
I've cursed a lot as well.
Okay.
It's an E for explicit show.
Listen,
don't worry.
I'm making my argument forcefully. So, you know, the idea that we made all the wrong trade-offs during COVID. But, you know, that schools should have been open the whole time, whatever, like the whole thing, right? And I think what those conversations, the lack of nuance in those conversations misses the idea that in any health policy or in any 15-minute interaction with a patient, there are trade-offs in terms of what you're prioritizing. Mm-hmm. And you want to be really thoughtful about what that is. And there's not always one right answer. So I will give you a really controversial example.
Okay.
New York and California in 2019... I actually don't remember if California was also 2019. New York for sure in 2019. 2019, there was the worst measles outbreak in the U.S. that there had been in the 21st century. And in response, New York did away with exemptions for school vaccine mandates. You had previously been allowed to get like religious exemptions that were pretty loose, right? Like you could sort of claim like a almost like a conscientious objector thing, mm-hmm. and get exempt from having to vaccinate your kids. And year after year, more kids were getting exempted. And then in 2019, in response to this measles outbreak, New York made a quick, hard, and fast law that said, no more exemptions. You're only exempt if you have like a true allergy or something. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you have to get your kids vaccinated to go to school. And you have to get all of them. You have to get all of the recommended vaccines on the schedule before five that are important. All of those vaccines are really important. And there was a measles outbreak. And there was a measles outbreak that was touching communities in New York State. So you can understand, and I think school vaccine mandates are incredibly important. And school vaccine mandates work. They get vaccine hesitant parents or parents who might not vaccinate simply because they like don't have time to take their kid to the doctor, they get those kids vaccinated.
Yeah.
So they're really important. It's a really important policy lever. And also, this de facto meant that for parents who might be inclined to get some of the vaccines and not all of the vaccines, which is true for lots of vaccine hesitant parents, that they are actually sort of cafeteria picking off of a menu. They're not actually like blanket
anti-vax. They've read
anti-vax.
Something about like one vaccine and they're like,
they've decided not to get, yeah, they've decided not to get the pertussis vaccine because of
or
whatever.
The HPV one. A lot of religious communities are like,
right,
no, not that
right
one.
And that one comes later, but like the earlier ones, like, you know, they're MMR hesitant, but they're willing to do the other one, mm-hmm. DTaP or whatever. A hard and fast rule like that intended to productively coerce people into getting their kids vaccinated who had previously not done so also meant that it put people in a position where maybe they just would decide to opt out of sending their kids to school or opt out of sending their kids to the public schools. I personally know a family that left the state of anti-vaxxers and moved to Texas. That's extreme. Mm-hmm. But it was at minimum an escalation in sort of an adversarial dynamic. And it's hard for me to say, do I think that we should have a hard and fast rule in which nobody who has any vaccine hesitancy can send their children to school or not? Mm-hmm. In order to try to get our vaccine rates up, like, is that the right thing? Colorado, which has a really, really high rates of vaccine hesitancy and, you know, is like a center of like the crunchy mom world. Colorado has vaccine mandates, but also does allow selective exemptions. And the trade-off there is they know that they have a lot of vaccine hesitant families and they're trying to get those kids into school. Mm-hmm. Which I can't exactly remember what I'm answering with this example. What was I answering?
Oh, you were talking about, how to respond to people about the vaccine hesitancy. And then you were like,
thinking about what the goals are, the encounter. Right.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty controversial example. Like, I am not endorsing the idea of getting rid of school mandates or making exemptions easier to get, but I am saying hard and fast vaccine mandates are going to put some families in the position of deciding whether or not they're going to send their kids to accredited schools in that state or move or homeschool or do other things. And that trade-off is a meaningful trade-off to consider, mm-hmm. in the same way that school closure during COVID was initially certainly done with the intention of protecting children and families, and also meant that there was learning loss and kids who never came back and all of the things that we now know.
Are you like sort of also, part of what I think maybe you're saying too is that there's a measles outbreak. Why wasn't the response narrowly tailored to that?
No, I mean, I think measles is so contagious that you can't really do that. It's not like,
no,
you can't,
I mean, in terms of like making the vaccine mandate about measles vaccine rather than all vaccines.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of lots of different options around how you think about, I think looking for the space between the most, collectivist, but also coercive, mm-hmm. Set of recommendations, and the ones that are sort of the least collective-minded, the most individualistic. Like, there's actually quite a lot of space for most things in between those things. The obvious thing there is a recommended pediatric vaccine schedule. Many, 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 many families already deviate from that schedule now in the way that they vaccinate their kids. They mm-hmm. say to the doctor, that's too many shots in one visit. We'll come back and get the other ones later, mm-hmm. or whatever it is. That is not ideal because the vaccine schedule is what it is for a reason. Mm-hmm. And also, if those kids end up getting vaccinated, do I want to pick a fight with that parent?
Yeah.
So that they don't come back to see me again? Or do I want to say, okay, what schedule works for you? Let's do that, mm-hmm. and try to work with them around it. The goal for me is to get the MMR into people's arms. Yeah. And so in my mind, that means that there needs to be trust. There needs to be real responsiveness to people's concerns. You need to afford parents a sense of agency in making the decision, mm-hmm. if you can. Can we think about how we, you know, design policy and also talk about that policy and communicate recommendations in a way that emphasizes those things rather than you do this and if you don't do this, you're a bad citizen?
So, you know, I think that this has been actually like really useful from like an individualist perspective, particularly, I mean, I think as part of a conversation that is ongoing within the medical community around, you know, how should nurses, how should doctors, how should all medical professionals be engaging with their patients? And I want to move this into the area of the political for most of us who are not doctors, who people are not coming to us for like, you know, I want this shot, not that shot, or whatever it is. They're not coming to us for advice about their health or their kids' health. And I think particularly I want to move into this realm of like, how should policymakers, liberal policymakers and politicians who are very concerned with the rise of anti-vaxxers, particularly, and I mean, the lessons that are being taken from the COVID-19 pandemic for future, definitely future pandemics and future public health emergencies. And, you know, the White House tweets this out, right, about I mentioned this earlier, about the rise in autism, right? And, you know, Matt Iglesias, who is best known for being a columnist at The Argument, wrote a piece for his side blog recently, Slow Boring, which we'll link in show notes, you know, pointing to the classic, you know, argument that liberals point out or pro-vaccine people point out about, like, you know, yeah, we made diagnostic shifts in the late 20th century. And of course, also there's a cultural shift that's happened that made it more possible for people to access care for autism diagnoses, and also became more acceptable for people to have autism diagnoses. Our perceptions of people with autism changed to include more high-functioning individuals as well. There were also polls, for instance, like you get accommodations in various places for having an autism diagnosis. And so like there are like a lot of things that are changing in this time period that are going to increase mechanically the number of people who have autism, even if it isn't actually changing the physiology of the underlying population that those statistics are referencing. And, you know, it's like, I think the classic lib thing to do is like to go, LOL, dumbasses, haven't you seen how the DSM changed over the course of the 20th century? And it's like, I think that this is something that like you've pointed out, a lot of people pointed out, like the people who are the most outspoken within like the anti-vax community, like know every single fact better than you. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yes. If I was on a podcast with these people, like they would like wipe the floor with me. I'm like, I don't know what you're
there
talking about.
There are no like women in STEM, like yeah. The Maha Moms.
Yeah.
Okay.
Literally. And like, often like are making arguments that have the form of like, you know, claim, evidence, conclusion. Like there's like a thing happening there, even yeah. If like a real scientist who was engaged would be like, okay, you're misreading that study, you're citing something that's like less, you know, you could do that. But like I just don't view this as like something that's going to be like debated out of people. So like what should politicians do then? Because like you witness the White House say this, and then what do you do?
Yeah, so I 100% agree. I think that the misinformation frame is terrible.
Yeah.
And inaccurate. I think sure. Some people are participating in information ecosystems where everything they see is you know, like contributes to like an almost QAnon, like, you know, sort of paracosm worldview of like yeah. what's happening. And that is that misinformation? Like, it's definitely not true. It's misinformation. But like, yeah. But the idea that like you could just correct people into mm-hmm. agreeing with us is, I think, has been pretty clearly disproven, mm-hmm. Because we do nothing but lose people. We don't gain anyone back. And I think that's because we are having the wrong conversations. So they come with. They come with charts and studies, and they say this study shows this incredibly strong association, and nobody would publish it because it was being suppressed by big medical journal and pharma. But it was done by this person at Harvard, who then Harvard fired. And like, right, like there are. It's very, very, very hard to be like, well, our evidence is better than that. Like,
yeah.
It's and this is why sort of I've written about this, that I think the anti-science frame is the wrong frame. I mean, they are very invested in science. They are just invested in a parallel scientific literature and a parallel set of experts and a parallel sort of mode of critical appraisal of what they think is valid. It relates, the question you're asking, which is about vaccines, relates to the question that sort of is being debated on podcasts around the world around, around what it's, you know, like what does it look like? Should we be trying to reach these people, or are they lost to us? Are we just waiting for all their kids to, like, you know, get measles and then they suffer the consequences and they learn better? Which is, there are definitely people who think that, who are basically like, this is lost. And until 200 kids die from measles a year, we should wash our hands of it. I extremely don't feel that way, but that is one sort of strain of thought. There are other people who think you can sort of disinfo, misinfo, like fight facts with facts, it out of them. I think that's wrong too. I think to me, the question of sort of how you reach people on the other side, especially people who you really need, and I don't even mean as voters, but for these folks, you need them to vaccinate because, like, you need to have 95%, a 95% immunity rate to keep measles at bay. And, like, lots and lots of communities around the country already are below that. So I think a few things. I think you have to be sincerely interested, which very few people currently engaged in this conversation seem to be about the other side. So I think you have to be genuinely interested. Like, where did it come from? Mm-hmm. What is hard for you that this is something that's preoccupied you and taken over your life? What are you worried about for your kid? Why are you worried about that? Like, there's a lot of rich sort of information to mine there that we have not made any gesture of interest toward. We're mm-hmm. just like, do this thing that we're telling you to do. So people are really worried about the health of their children. And I want to understand that better. And I want to partner with them in that concern.
Yeah. You know, I think this actually gets at something that I've been thinking about for a while, which is like, even the question I asked you situates the political problem at the wrong moment. Like, by the time the White House is tweeting there's a 400% increase in autism diagnoses, and then we have people talking about, like, in power that, like, vaccines and Tylenol are the reason for it, like, that's not the point at which, like, effective political engagement is really going to happen. It's before then. Like, every conversation that truth-seeking institutions are having around these questions, like, how are those being conducted? And then, you know, when journalists are writing articles that are, like, not about this specific episode, but are about, in general, like, why is there a rise in autism? Like, hey, like, I see, like, you know, I'm a local journalist, I'm writing about this in my community. Like, how are those concerns being talked about? Are you, like, are those articles being written from a perspective of, like, I am sincerely interested in figuring out what this opposite group believes? Or is it from this perspective of just, like, oh, like, and then at the end of the card, there's all these lunatics who showed up to the town hall to say that, like, we should not force their kids to, like, do whatever. Like, there's, like, these, all of these other things, I think, contribute totally. So much more to people's expectations and understandings of, like, the pro-vaccine side of the aisle.
And to what degree are we invested in our own mythology and sort of allowing ourselves to achieve premature closure on questions that are actually not closed? So even on Tylenol, mm-hmm. it's just that the entire evidence base is very small. And Matt Iglesias contributed to the argument in that side blog post, wrote about this sibling study that was done that is supposed, that's sort of like the best of the studies we have on this question, which looked at the relationship between Tylenol use during pregnancy and incidence of autism, but then compared it in the kids who have autism to their siblings to try to control for, like, basically, like, okay, well, it came from the same parent with the same behaviors and the same genetics and everything else. And then, so all these people were writing, all these evidence bros, these vax maxers. They were all like
vax maxers. Amazing! I'm a vax maxer.
You're a vax maxer. You're a vax maxer and a fax maxer. And and all the fax maxing vax maxers were mm-hmm. writing these like slam dunk, like, well, your the evidence that you've presented that shows the association is weak and it's been beaten by the sibling study.
Yeah.
And then Jay Bhattacharya, who's the head of the NIH, who's in a weird spot for lots of reasons that we could talk about or not, but we probably don't have time, is sort of trying to, in his own way, thread this needle of still, like, maintaining some scientific integrity while being totally associated with this clown show. Mm-hmm. He wrote this thread being like, okay, there are actually all of these different potential problems with sibling studies. Here are a bunch of ways in which we should be skeptical of results in sibling studies, whether or not sort of some, like, definitive gold standard. Now, Jay's being selective there because, like, this administration's relying on all sorts of weak evidence for stuff. But the point is that science is progressive and self-correcting. This is not a question like the MMR and autism. MMR and autism, we could not have more data about. We can be pretty definitive in our in a statement that says that the MMR vaccine does not cause autism. Is there some potential increase in risk of autism rates in some kids with certain genetic propensities if they have some threshold of Tylenol exposure prenatally? I don't think we have a 100% definitive answer to that question yet. And I think statements that said there is no association, this is 100% safe, were statements that were not, they weren't intellectually honest.
But I think what's hard about this is I hear exactly what you're saying. And I'm like, when I say I know something to be true, I am not saying I have reviewed the evidence and I have found randomized controlled trials in 5,000 different contexts that have all shown my side of the aisle to be correct. It is like, we say we know things when we have a certain threshold of belief, because I know that tomorrow morning the sun will rise. I know that when I log onto my computer, I can click this little icon that says Slack and all these messages will bombard me. I've done scientific research. I have experience and views and ways of knowing are not all one way. And so sometimes I worry that expressing this level of credulity towards these views, you're right, it's possible that Tylenol could cause cancer, are we getting to the point where we are then platforming and making more likely that people who are not involved in this conversation now become more and more concerned? Because again, with Tylenol, the other problem is that Tylenol is beneficial in pregnancy for reducing, and in young children for reducing fevers, and we actually know that those things are harmful. So I think that in many of those respects, I worry about whether we're going to end up increasing the exposure to this idea.
But Drew, I think this is the challenge right now for what it means to do effective public health communication in the contemporary era, which is how do you communicate within and around uncertainty, and the impulse to be overly definitive in your conclusions or your recommendations consistently ends up undermining credibility when we end up having to revise ourselves. And COVID was certainly an example of that over and over again. We told people they didn't need to mask, then we told them they did need to mask, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There were better ways, probably. We told them that the vaccine would prevent transmission, and then it didn't. Mm-hmm. If we could, and I think this is a challenge and not one that we've sort of figured out so well, but figuring out what it means to communicate with uncertainty is that's the thing we have to figure out how to do. And then the other thing I would say is that the information about what the studies show, you don't need to know every RCT about Tylenol. There aren't any, but you don't have to know every RCT about Tylenol. You
RCTs for getting pregnant. And then
what you need to do is know what you're worried about, what your level of risk tolerance is, how you think about risks and benefits of various things, how much pain you're experiencing during pregnancy, right? If you're a person who goes through a pain-free, fever-free pregnancy, this doesn't come up for you. If you're a person who has significant pain every day that's impairing your ability to move around, which some people do in pregnancy, and Tylenol helps with that pain, that really changes the risk-benefit calculus here. If you're a person who's deeply anxious about the idea that anything you do could harm your fetus, maybe you decide you're going to abstain from Tylenol because the smallest chance makes you feel really anxious. But if you're me, who ate sushi all the time during both of my pregnancies, then you're like, this is a minuscule risk. And the benefit is I really love sushi and I'm going to keep eating it. So the way we make decisions is not based on information alone. And this anxiety that giving people more nuance is going to push them to make the wrong decision, I think. It doesn't reflect the way that people actually act.
I want to have kids. I've not been pregnant before. But I didn't, I'm like, became aware in the last, as every single woman with an Instagram does, by the time you turn 27, all of a sudden you get bombarded with like mommy content, like all the time. And then I became aware of all of these rules, and I actually like didn't know were rules. Like, I didn't know the sushi thing was a rule. I didn't know the deli meat thing was a rule. Like, if I had
just
not,
I ate deli meat also.
Like, it's, you eat deli meat? Yeah, you're just killing it. And your kids are amazing, so I guess it's fine.
Tylenol.
But like, I just, so, Tylenol sandwiches with deli meat. I just think that like, I would not have even been aware of this concern. Like, now I'm like, okay, like I want to get pregnant. I've gotten married. And now I'm like, okay, so like, now I need to go like read every Emily Oster book and like find out like, is there a spot? Like, and, like, I think at this level to which like, I would have just like done my, I would have just like lived my life. I would have continued to eat sushi. I would have continued to live that way. And like, I think the question here is like, there is a small population of people for whom this is a very like live debate and like that they're having within themselves. Like, again, like we talked about them like potentially being electorally relevant, but even if they are, it's not like the majority of the country. We're talking about a small group of people for whom this is very, very live in their lives. And then like the messaging that comes out of presidential administrations, out of state administrations, et cetera, is going to like everyone. And so like, is the message that they're supposed to be sending narrowly tailored to this small group?
No. Or is it? I mean, I wish it was not.
Yeah.
I wish it was not, of course. You know, I think the whole thing was a disaster. It was very bad. Like, none of this is to be like, it wasn't bad. None of this is to be like, he has a point. Mm-hmm. None of this is to be like, you should worry about Tylenol. It's all to say that operating with a high level of certainty and motivated certainty around questions that are actually quite nuanced and that are as much about values and priorities and circumstances as they are about facts is not a productive way to help people make healthy decisions in their lives. And what I would say for you is like, the problem is Instagram, right? Like 25 years ago, you would have bought like Expecting the Baby books and read this one book, like this one book that everybody else read, and everybody would kind of have the same advice, you know, and except for what they got from word of mouth or whatever. And that's not the information environment we're in right now. And so it would be really wrong, I think, and it has been really wrong for sort of what I'll call the public health establishment, to yearn for an information environment we no longer have. We don't control the message, and nor do they. Yeah. And so what happened is this Tylenol announcement happened, and within a day, professional medical societies around the country had put out counter statements with their own recommendations. Mm-hmm. Pediatricians around the country are giving, and obstetricians around the country are giving advice that says, that's totally counter to what it's not the law. They didn't pass a law, right? So we are in right now an information environment where there are multiple sources of authority contesting for the patient's trust. And I think the way that we ought to be operating in that environment is be really interested in what it looks like to build trust given all of that noise.
Yeah.
And really interested in what has failed in the past to land with people and what we should do differently.
Well, Rachel, it's been a great conversation, and we've talked about a lot of takes that get you heated, but I want to ask you our final question, which is, what is an argument, a blog post, a piece of advice, a book, an article that you come across recently that has really pissed you off?
Okay, so I'm going to give an example involving a pal of ours, a close friend of the argument, who's been taking a lot of heat for this very take over the last couple of weeks. So Ezra Klein has been doing a podcast tour of his own where he's been the guest on a series of podcasts recently talking about what the Democrats need to do differently in order to have a hope of ever regaining power in this country. And he has sort of infamously, I think, on Ross Douthat's podcast, while advancing the idea that Democrats need to be willing to moderate on issues where sort of the Democratic orthodoxy is not in line with voters' priorities. The example that he gave was, for example, maybe we need to start, if we want to win Senate seats in Kansas and Missouri and Ohio, I think were the three examples he gave, Kansas, Missouri, and Ohio, we need to be willing to potentially run pro-life candidates. And as many people have pointed out to him online, because everything poor Ezra says gets a lot of blowback. But I'm doing it also.
Poor Ezra.
Poor Ezra. But Ezra.
Yeah.
That was a bad example. Mm. And I say that to somebody who was intimately involved in the ballot initiative efforts in all three of those states to pass pro-choice ballot initiatives that would reverse total abortion bans, mm-hmm. That passed after Dobbs. So in Kansas, Ohio, and Missouri, the voters chose, a majority of voters in all three of those states chose to pass basically Roe-style protections. And it's not just, the reason that this take bothered me mm-hmm. wasn't just that I think it's not a great example of what he's trying to say, which is you want to align your candidate's values with the voters' values, because in this case, that would have been a misalignment, actually.
Yeah.
But more because I think it reflected sort of a lack of thoughtfulness that's pervasive to this conversation that Democrats are having as a whole about what it means to be aligned with voters' values in the first place. The way that those ballot initiatives were won was not by taking sort of the standard Democratic Party, Planned Parenthood, Repro Group line on abortion. It was not by communicating with voters that, like, abortion on demand is what they should all be expected to support. Mm-hmm. It was very much after sort of lots of thoughtful research in those states, figuring out a message that would respect the fact that even people who were themselves ambivalent about abortion or who identified as pro-life, that those people ultimately did not want to support laws that would criminalize abortion for their neighbors. And so those initiatives passed because, not because everybody's pro-choice in those places, but because people are actually nuanced and sensitive and thoughtful and less cruel than I think we usually think. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of room to connect with them in a way that doesn't demand that they change their values, but also doesn't mean that you are going to advocate for policy that is punitive or draconian or whatever. And I think it's worth being really curious about why those initiatives were successful. And sort of like how those campaigns pulled that off and what is replicable there for around other questions and other efforts. I think there's just a lot more space between the extreme positions on most of the things that we're arguing about than we currently allow for in the discourse.
Yeah.
So, sorry, Ezra, but I thought,
you know, it's funny.
I thought it was a bad example because I think there's tons to learn from what happened in those states around abortion that informs exactly the questions he's interested in, and he wasn't thinking about it the right way.
Yeah, I do think it's like this like broader point that you just made around how we think about what it means to align with voters' values being like way too oversimplified.
It's like so on the nose.
Yeah, it's also just like, I mean, I remember this happening in the wake of the presidential election when Seth Moulton made those comments about how he wouldn't want his daughter playing with on a sports team with trans girls, I guess, because his daughter's underage. And there's like an obviously true thing here where there's a lot of people in this country who both don't understand or understand and decided they just disagree about whether or not trans women should be able to play in cis women's sports leagues. But like a whole bunch of people who have like very strong opinions about this, which I don't really understand, but like that's a true thing that is happening. And like people who are trying to run for office should engage thoughtfully with like, why do you feel this way? What things are happening? If something happened to your daughter in the classroom, like maybe you're actually afraid in many respects of like actually boys that are causing harm to your daughter and you are now transferring that fear into wanting to maintain all cis female spaces. Whatever's going on, like people should be engaged in that. But like, to me, the idea that like the average American thinks it's like in line with their values to say about like, I mean, I forget how old Seth Moulton's daughter is, but like, what about like children? They're like a child who is saying that they're a trans woman and is wanting to play sports as a kid. that, like, we should talk about them as if they're, like, this, like, hulking behemoth that's gonna, like, destroy, like, beat up your daughter on the sports field. I'm like, is that really what most people feel about this issue? Like, I don't think so. Like, I think the fact that, like, the majority of the country is opposed to trans women playing in women's sports, but I don't think they're, like, excited about their congressman going, like, yeah, like, I don't want my daughter playing with, like, some girl who's gonna beat her. I'm like, we're talking about a kid. We're talking about, like, children. Like, you know what I mean? And so I think this, like, happens a lot in this moderation conversation where, like, I fully agree that, like, it is clearly obvious to me that, like, on a variety of issues, liberals have gotten, are, like, my values are not the median of this country. Like, that is just true. It's just not true that, like, people just all agree with me on everything, even though, after they listen to our podcast, I'm sure they all will. But, you know, I just think it's not, the idea that just means then we should just take, like, these maximally, like, basic opinions or I think blunt opinions on these issues, like, doesn't really track.
I clearly feel that way. And I feel that way about the vaccine questions, which is like, I think I keep saying that you have to be sincerely interested, but I think you have to be sincerely interested in what people believe, in the sort of total nuance of it and why they believe it, mm-hmm. and where the potential points of alignment are that are not totally obvious on the surface. Yeah. And then with those points of alignment, is there policy that maybe everyone agrees on that feels good, or maybe there's policy that basically is effectively harm reduction in that it's less bad than the worst version of the policy that could be in place right now. And I keep hearing folks on our side over and over again sort of have this conversation about this argument about, like, where are the lines? What are we not willing to do? What are we willing to do? Like, you know, is the pressure that so we should just give everything up and moderate on everything. Mm-hmm. You know me, I'm not a popularist and I'm not a moderate, mm-hmm. like, at all. Because of my doctor work, I have had thousands of conversations with people who don't agree with me about things where I have to find common ground with them and build trust with them in a way that gets us to a productive outcome that we can both leave the room feeling okay about. And that's the tone that I think mm-hmm. we ought to be taking around these conversations that's currently missing.
Yeah, I mean, we could obviously do an entire whole other podcast about this, but, like, the one thing I'll just say is that, like, I think that many of these things that these conversations you're referencing around, like, oh, like, what lines can we draw? It presumes that you already know all of the answers, both about other people's views and about the truth of the matter, in a way that already, like, actually already undermines your ability to create connection with people. Because they're like, oh, you're drawing lines because you already know everything. You know all the answers. You know who's right and who's wrong. And, like, you're the arbiter of that. And, like, even if we're completely right about the issues that we care about, like, obviously I believe I'm right. I wouldn't have these opinions if I thought they were wrong. Like, there's a level to which it's like, who has the power to draw lines? Do we have the power to draw lines anymore? Like, we lost. Like,
you know, we lost.
So.
Yeah. And the abortion stuff was doing the abortion ballot initiative work was so fascinating because I did get to sort of learn. I got to learn about these, like, red state. I saw all of this research from red states about abortion, and it was just so much more. It was so rich compared to the top lines. If you sort of saw the focus group stuff and the journal stuff, and, you know, like, and that's missing in the way that we talk about these most sort of contentious cultural issues right now.
Yeah. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
The Arguments production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.